Late-stage capitalism isn't working out so great for people and the planet. But what's the alternative?
There are hundreds of really interesting projects across the full diversity of enterprise, from alternative currencies to agroecology and CSA farms, to urban commons, to peer production, to cosmo-local production, in which open source design is shared globally, but you produce real stuff locally. And I wanted to bring all these things together in one spot, like the way the Whole Earth catalog did in the 1960s, early 70s, to show that there is like a huge counterculture of significantly different ways of meeting our needs that are arguably post-capitalist and climate-friendly.
That's David Bollier. We talk with him about his latest book, The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. Then we listen back to an excerpt from our 2015 interview with Katha Pollitt about her book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's becoming pretty clear that our current economic system is leading us straight over the cliff. Whether you call it predatory capitalism or neoliberalism, the whole notion of subordinating all socioeconomic and environmental needs to endlessly increasing short-term profit for a tiny elite is, well, nuts. But what's a workable alternative? One that can promote well-being and democracy? David Bollier says the answer is both new and age-old. He calls it commoning. Commoners seek to prioritize people's needs over market extraction, steward the earth, relocalize the economy, and build new institutions of empowerment. And Bollier's Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking is a kind of whole earth catalog for the 21st century. It explains the transformational power of social collaboration by showcasing dozens of pathbreaking projects, books, websites, and activist initiatives. It's an indispensable tool to a livable future. David Bollier is a global leader in the commoning movement. He's the author of numerous books, including Fair, Free, and Alive, Think Like a Commoner, and Brand Name Bullies. And we've talked with him about all those books and more before on the show. David Bollier, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be with you again.
The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. You know, once upon a time, there was the Whole Earth Catalog, Tools for Living. This is Tools for Changemaking. And what really struck me about it, is that it's a very optimistic book. Talk a little bit about that optimistic frame that you bring to this book.
Well, you know, the mainstream media and politics have their own biases about what's important, what they want to entertain. But beyond the gaze of their, you know, mainstream perspective, there are hundreds of really interesting projects across the full diversity of enterprise, from alternative currencies to agroecology and CSA farms, to urban commons, to peer production, to cosmo-local production, in which open source design is shared globally, but you produce real stuff locally, and on and on. And I wanted to bring all these things together in one spot, sort of like the way the Whole Earth catalog did in the 1960s, early 70s, to show that there is like a huge counterculture of significantly different ways of meeting our needs that are arguably post-capitalist and climate-friendly, but being ignored or denigrated by the mainstream players.
You say hundreds, though, and one of the questions that I have is, how do you move from a small scale to a larger scale? And I'm not sure you can really answer that question, but take a stab at that.
Well, I don't have to take a stab. I've encountered this a lot in my travels as a commons advocate and scholar. And people say, well, how does it scale? And the presumption in the question is that you're going to have a single or large centralized organization that's, you know, dictating this the way the hierarchical capitalist institutions do. And frankly, that's part of the problem. The future, as this Belgian designer once put it in a short phrase, the next big thing will be a lot of small things. And the challenge is to develop this horizontally. The phrase that I like to use is emulate and federate. And it's very similar to internet activity, where you have, whether it's open source or Wikipedia or a lot of transnational digital projects like open access publishing and many others. It's about emulating each other in ways that are true to your local circumstances at the appropriate scale, but federating into systems of mutual help and support. And you have significant impact, but you're all quasi-autonomous and rooted. And so you can't be co-opted or wiped out as easily as conventional politics often does.
That makes sense. You know, we've spoken to you quite a few times through the years about the commons, starting with your book, Brand Name Bullies, which criticized the enclosure of the digital commons. Well, actually, Brand Name Bullies, not so much the digital commons, that was another book, but copyright. It was about copyright, which is also the enclosure, I guess, of the intellectual commons in a way.
Yes, the application of expansive property rights to all sorts of creativity and culture and information to the detriment of sharing and cooperation, open source style.
And you point out in this book that the word is really not the commons, it's commoning, that commoning is a verb. So tell us, what is commoning?
Well, first of all, we have to get past the so-called tragedy of the commons parable, which is often used to say that shared wealth can't be managed successfully. It has to be privatized, which was the famous tragedy of the commons article by Garrett Hardin in the late 60s. But commons are actually a set of activities by which a group of people coordinate, negotiate, communicate, have ritualized togetherness, celebrations by which they manage their shared wealth. And so it's a whole set of activities that are always in dynamic flow. And once you get your mind around that, you start to realize that commoning can happen everywhere, anywhere, and in fact is happening everywhere. And you start to see that it's a social system and not simply a resource that individuals are managing as individuals. It's a more holistic social system.
Well, give us an example of commoning in a way that maybe people aren't realizing that they're doing it.
Well, I suppose, let me just say, historically, indigenous peoples are probably have the most developed and sophisticated forms of commoning, because over centuries or millennia, they developed systems of mutual governance and working with the land that was all organic and relational. It was a whole system. But that happens, it's almost like a natural impulse of humanity to work in that fashion. And we see this in so many digital spaces where you get into it and you say, oh, I have this, I can help you with that. And there's, despite the prevalence of Facebook and Twitter and the other corporate sponsored platforms, the natural inclination is to share, cooperate, and produce things of mutual value. The question is whether we can own the value we create, or whether that's going to be ceded to the corporate owners of the platforms and that we're just digital serfs on their plantation. So things like, I've already mentioned a few of these, the prominent ones like Linux and open source software and Wikipedia, which has tens of thousands of participants around the world and dozens of languages. Digital spaces are familiar, but we see it in things like community-supported agriculture or community land trusts, which help decommodify land and take it off speculative markets, in which people work together to make these things happen. There's a whole thing, set of models called platform cooperatives, in which, as an alternative to Airbnb and Uber, people are developing user or worker-owned platforms online for providing similar services. But instead of the extractive mentality of Silicon Valley, using markets and big capital to rip people off, it's owned like a cooperative and it's for everyone's benefit. So there's a lot of these examples happening, not just in the United States, but around the world. And that's what my Commoners catalog is trying to showcase.
You know, it is so interesting. And I just really wonder how it happened. I mean, when the internet first began, it was really heralded as a kind of commons. And it seems that it was almost an inevitable progression of, you know, capitalism, predatory capitalism, basically taking it over like it takes is trying to take over every single last piece of the commons that we have left in every way. And, you know, that was an economic thing, but it also seemed like, I mean, it just happened without people being able to even be aware of what all of a sudden it was just there. Is that a misperception on my part?
No, that's totally, absolutely true. There's both a kind of naivete, especially in the United States, and a self-delusion that you get an open system and it's going to emancipate everyone. In the early 90s, the growth of the World Wide Web was heralded as this epical transformational shift. And it was in a certain way, but not in the way that people like John Perry Barlow and other digital champions argued, because they don't take account of the fact that capital is always going to try to monetize this created wealth. They just didn't realize that social interactions could be monetized so readily. And so we saw there's a wave of this happening from originally with open source software, but then with the rise of the blogosphere and then social media. Couch surfing was going to be this hospitality gift economy. It turned out to be taken over and became a kind of marketized travel service. So to talk about the commons is to start to get a little more grown up and sophisticated about these dynamics of the, let's call it the appropriation, dispossession, and seizure of our commonwealth. And the point is, we need to be mindful of this and preemptively develop the ways to protect that shared wealth.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about his latest book. It's a catalog, The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. And now, you know, you quote Buckminster Fuller in this book, David Bollier, in The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, where he says, "You never change things by fighting existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." And, you know, it's kind of like Marx talking about the new world rising within the ashes of the old. But the problem is that the existing reality really tries its darndest to squash and destroy the emergence of a new reality. So is it really an either or? I mean, don't we have to both fight back and create the new?
We absolutely do. I just want to be, as somebody who's very committed to system change, I want to be mindful of the limitations of, quote, working within the system. It's essential to work within the system to deal with the retrograde legislation, the regulations, the lawsuits, and all those things. But I've just seen over the course of my 40-year career in activism and political change, that also is kind of a setup for a dead end or limitations, because within the system as constituted, it's hard to articulate a vision and mobilize people around it. Even nonprofit groups whom I respect a great deal, end up managing their institution and fundraising and their brand identity because to assert a more risky long-term vision is to jeopardize their institutional security. So a lot of these efforts for change have to occur outside of the system by ordinary people at the grassroots and horizontal level, as opposed to in Washington at the centralized level. So I think it's a reality that both have to be functional and working. And I'd love to see more ways that those two sides, if you can call it, could cooperate. the way Greenpeace International recently launched a campaign in the midst of the Davos economic summits to showcase the alternative economic and social movements. And I think this is precisely the kind of collaborations we need between the, we call it the old guard, and the emergent alternatives.
I'm curious what your take is on cryptocurrency, because it is one of those things that's also touted as being democratic, it's not under the control of central banks. And yet it also really, well, for one thing, it is one of the worst things for the planet to happen because of the way data mining uses a huge amount of energy. I think it's like the sixth or the eighth largest country in the world, crypto mining, in terms of its energy use, but also seems to be a platform for scamming people.
Well, I agree with all of the above, but I would just hasten to add that the technology itself could be developed in alternative, more benign, or even constructive ways. But for the most part, you're right. Cryptocurrencies are capitalist speculative gambits, and oftentimes even scams. So I would just urge people to think that the so-called distributed ledger technology, which is the blockchain is all about, should be considered separately from Bitcoin or the dozens of alternative digital currencies or token systems or non-fungible tokens, NFTs, all of which are basically designed to make a killing in a speculative market and then to get out before the market collapses. But blockchain and distributed ledgers can be used in many cooperative, collaborative ways if they're designed properly, so that it's not a setup for the capitalist rip and run. And I would cite the Berkshire's currency in Western Massachusetts, which is sponsored by the Schumacher Center for New Economics, for which I work, which recently launched this digital smartphone-ready version of its regional currency, the Berkshares. And it uses blockchain to help clear transactions because it's a very effective tool for authenticated identity and transactions that are trustworthy. Now, this is quite different from the data mining that Bitcoin does. So I wanted to point out that there are creative uses of this technology that can have an emancipatory role. But we should try to train ourselves to look at that as opposed to the next shiny thing that Silicon Valley and speculators are rolling out.
And it would not use the kind of energy that...
Oh, precisely. Precisely. They're more of if they're actually an efficient way, arguably more efficient than conventional banking systems, and more to the point, more distributed, and therefore the banks can't be this gatekeeper bottleneck which it uses to make all of its money. So therefore, you could have more efficient and low-cost transactions or money transfers.
Your book, unabashedly, talks about a post-capitalist economy. Although, as we'll talk a bit later, there is some working within capitalism that's possible. You know, here again, the idea of creating the new within the ashes of the old, you know, the old takes a while to get to total ashes. So there's some transitional steps there. But talk about rethinking economics. Kim Stanley Robinson writes in his wonderful book, Ministry of the Future, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. So help us imagine a different economy, one that can work in the modern world.
Well, let's just say, first of all, it's not going to be enacted by Congress anytime soon. I think it's going to more grow in all sorts of pockets that are of the country or the world that can self-protect themselves from the capitalist appropriation and co-optation, which is the standard operating procedure. But this requires that we begin to think with a different logic that understands these terribly pathological and antisocial dynamics of capitalism without just falling into, dogmatic cant. In other words, what are the creative alternatives? And in the Commoner's Catalog, I point to a handful of alternative thinkers, such as Kate Raworth, who developed the idea of donut economics. And she makes the claim that the economy should be regarded as a donut, with the outer ring being regarded as the ecological ceiling for what the earth can withstand. And then the inner ring is the social foundation, meaning what are the minimum basic needs that everyone should have. So this is a great conceptual tool for thinking about an economy that respects limits and meets basic needs, and do this in the safe and just space for humanity in the inside of the donut, as she calls it. But there's other thinkers like Ivan Illich, who is the famous dissident Catholic social priest, who talked about vernacular culture and the importance of having bottom-up self-organization of things, of daily life. And he regards this as a way to deepen the human spirit in a way that top-down institutions often don't. And he talked about the need for convivial tools, by which he meant tools that we can adapt and use as we need, as we see fit, as opposed to the standard proprietary tools that we get from companies that are locked in and copyrighted and trademarked, and we can't use them except how they prescribe and then pay the licensing fees, the way, for example, Monsanto does for its seeds that it sells to farmers. So these are the kinds of ideas that we need to entertain in thinking about how the economy could work differently, and start to build them in functional models that are frankly already out there and working. They just need to proliferate. And I think that once they reach a certain scale, and we could say just even 2-4%, the big guys start to take notice and get worried, the way they did about Linux as an open source computer operating system in the 1990s. They said that, you know, Linux was criticized as communism by Microsoft because they realized that their proprietary business model was threatened by this. And in the same way, local food systems and organic food presented a major challenge to big ag, even though it was a relatively small market share or fraction of food production. So my point is, these alternatives, despite being small, if they're functional, if they're hardy, if they can resist capitalist appropriation, have the capacity to self-replicate and pose a moral indictment of the existing system, and start to be a focal point for a cultural shift, the way we've seen in a lot of different ways. So we need not worry too much about, well, how are we going to make it scale? It's more like, how can we make it functional over the long term and protect itself? And I think that's the way we start to build a new economy.
You mentioned in the book a Wi-Fi commons. And I remember when, and I think there are cities or municipalities, and much like public power, you know, there's near me, there's a town, Greenpoint, New York, that owns its own power facility, where the rest of us are under the neck of LIPA, of Long Island Power Authority, which we're actually trying to make a public, more truly public. But Wi-Fi commons, and now you have companies that are writing laws for legislatures. ALEC, you know, the American Legislative something.
Exchange.
Council. Exchange. Yeah. The Koch brothers, one of the Koch brothers, fronts, which are prohibiting the very kind of scaling that you're talking about. So how do we, our capitalist overlords, they're not dumb, they know what the threat is, and they're going to be ruthless in overcoming it. What can one do about pushing back, let's say, these kinds of laws?
Well, I think I have two responses. One has to do with our mental framework about it. That's why I think the commons is valuable, because it can start to assert these are shared things that we need to protect, and we can start to assess it that way, as opposed to a lot of, frankly, mainstream Democrats who say, oh, well, the market will take care of it. And they're just a little too obliging of their own corporate paymasters through campaign finances and their faith in the market to solve problems. I think we've seen that during the pandemic, that that's just not true. And the commons helps us develop a different analysis, a different framework for understanding what's really going on and how, for example, a Wi-Fi commons could serve us so much better. But we have to confront real politics. And that's where our previous talk about the old guard and the emergent alternatives need to learn to cooperate better. Because frankly, you're right. The capital often goes to legislatures to outlaw the emergent alternatives that might threaten their business models. Just, you know, imagine if Microsoft had been able to outlaw open source software. It did a lot of other nasty things using intellectual property law, but it wasn't able to stifle open source. And in fact, in some ways, it helped ride the coattails or co-opt some of open source. My point is, the old players within the political system on the progressive side need to learn to acknowledge and work with these emergent alternatives and present a more united front than historically they've been able to do. So that's sort of, I think, the challenge.
And I think also changing the values, that in a way this is what's absolutely crucial here is to actually open people's minds up to the possibilities of acting in a different way. You mentioned...
Can I just add something to that point? To act in a different way, but to do it with structural alternatives so that we don't have to depend upon a regulatory agency or a court to necessarily fulfill the enactment of it. That's been the historic problem, because you get the law passed, and then you have another gauntlet to go through with regulatory development and enforcement, and then even litigation. So the point of the commons is to make these autonomous of a corruptible political system. So I wanted to add that point as a really important one, to work outside of the standard liberal framework.
Yeah, exactly. One of the areas in reimagining the economy is to relocalize the economy. Explain what that means, and also explain how you can link it to something very global, the open source software movement, which we've just been talking about.
Well, you know, so many problems have arisen, we've seen over the past two or three years of the pandemic, with very fragile global supply chains. You may have seen the photo that was in the newspapers about this enormous tanker that ran aground in the Suez Canal. And it's sort of a perfect metaphor for all sorts of problems, from computer chips to medical devices and drugs and many other things, that in a tightly integrated global system are easily disrupted, or maybe they can keep going, but they will cost a whole lot more. So the point of relocalization is to develop a more resilient place-based economy. The bioregion strikes me as the most logical way to do that, in which you depend as much as possible on your own resources and people, and you try to replace the imports from outside the region as much as possible. Now, this will develop not only a more robust local economy, but one that's more resilient in the face of disruptions, which we're likely to have in the coming years and decades. And so we see this, for example, in people developing relocalized food systems, where agriculture is conducted closer to where the food is actually eaten, instead of from New Zealand or, you know, Africa. And trying to develop the greater local self-reliance is really an important thing going forward, also for the sense of democratic accountability of the economy, because you're closer to it. You can petition legislators who are not necessarily as ideologically driven, but more practically driven, the way we see in a lot of so-called urban commons movements in places like Barcelona and Amsterdam. So relocalization has a lot of benefits, and it comes off of the wisdom of such forebears as E.F. Schumacher in his famous book, Small is Beautiful, or people like Murray Bookchin or Jane Jacobs or other champions of localism as a way to reclaim democracy, our economy, and even more humane ways of living.
Yet you also link it to something that is very global, and that's the open source software movement. So what are the connections? I mean, in a world where, of course, so much is accomplished digitally, I mean, I can, this podcast is listened to all over the world, for example, even though I produce it just right here in my own home. So talk about that interplay between localization, democracy, and global, you know, a global open source economy.
Well, one movement that really is at the nub of this is called the Cosmo-Local Production Movement. And this is about using shareable design and knowledge the way open source does in a global fashion, where you have, you know, people who are experts on building houses or motor vehicles or furniture or electronic circuit boards, who as a global community are creating fantastic high quality designs. But then you have local production of the physical stuff, hence Cosmo Local as the term. And this could have enormous implications for reducing supply chains, reducing carbon emissions, and still meeting needs. The problem, of course, is that it bypasses the large centralized capital driven corporations, and it creates more regional sovereignty and control. So there's a political issue there that will have to be confronted at some point. And similarly, you'll have to have changes in property law and finance to facilitate these kinds of ways. But they have a bona fide efficiency and quality to them. Can we usher them forward? Those are some of the financial and legal hacks we're going to have to do to make them work.
David Bollier. Stay tuned for more about the Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with David Bollier about the Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. So the book is filled with very inspiring projects. And one thing that I was really interested to think about was the page on the new animism, because it was just yesterday, actually, or was it? No, it was a couple of days ago that I was thinking to myself, the way that I am evolving a consciousness of the personhood of everything that I meet, which is has been happening for the last few years, even now extending to the insects in my garden that I used to just squash. And now I'm thinking about them as persons and, you know, thinking, do I want to squash them or do I want to just repel them or relocate them or give them a little bit of my produce anyway? And I realized that it's much like now I'm thinking like human beings thought for, you know, hundreds of millennia, which is a kind of animism, something that we always thought of as primitive, but actually now I realize is just the way things really are. So talk about the new animism.
Well, there's a number of people ranging from eco-philosophers to cultural theorists to you might say actual practitioners of agriculture or others that start to realize that the world is not just a, in the famous quote of Thomas Berry, the world is not a collection of objects, it's a communion of subjects. That means it's full of life. And we shouldn't understand insects or other living beings as simple machines for us to use as we see fit, or the earth is just this dead, inert soil and minerals, but as something that's living and alive. And this is what the Gaia hypothesis is all about, that the earth is not just earth system science, it's a living being that has emerged through the dense interconnections of living creatures, just as our own bodies are an amazing collection of bacteria, the biome, and all these different other living systems. So the new animism is trying to, in some ways, maybe coming from a Western and scientific perspective, come to the same place that a lot of indigenous people have known for millennia, that of course the earth is a living system, and of course other creatures and even plants have this living essence, meaning they're each struggling to survive and thrive and fulfill a certain you might call creative adaptive identity that they're born to do as creatures. And the more people study the life of mushrooms and mycelium, the roots underneath the trees and how they interconnect the forest and how the trees and the soil of the forest actually has a social life, if you want to call it that, of intercommunication, the more these things become evident that the world is a relational place and not just, you know, us as individual creatures living within our skulls with our rationality. The world becomes alive and beautiful and much more worthy of protecting than simply, you know, using the extractive capitalist norms to clear-cut a forest and to strip the minerals from the earth. So the new animism is a fascinating new development that I think has a lot of promise as people wake up to the reality of life.
And you connect this, or this gets expressed in something called convivial conservation, which you contrast to some of the other conservation efforts. You know, for example, there's the movement half Earth should be given over to nature and human beings live in the other half, and also kind of the conventional conservation. Talk about how convivial conservation is different from them.
Well, instead of seeing nature as something to be conserved in plots of land and then let the rest of the capitalist machine do its business, this is more about convivial, meaning people have a social engagement and relationship with the earth in a mutually constructive way. The way, you know, indigenous peoples altered their own landscape, but in ways that were utterly respectful and often ecologically constructive. And I think that the idea is not so much to ban human beings from this place or the next, because they will invariably ruin it, but more to develop the social practices and cultural norms that allow people to interact in a more sustainable, respectful way of nature over time. And so this is a new, conceptualization or strategy for the conservation movement that invites a lot of conventional conservation players to leave the idea of conservation as a fortress to protect nature, which still basically objectifies nature as other and separate, as opposed to regarding nature as something we're immersed in that we need to have a relationship with. And convivial conservation is the way to do that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about his latest book. It's a catalog, The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. I mean, could an example of that be, say, sowing pollinator-friendly plants by roadway?
Yes, or turning, I suppose, there's all sorts of ways that one can deepen one's engagement with nature, community forests. A lot of people are turning their lawns into meadows. I've heard of community land trusts entering into collaborations with indigenous people, Native Americans, to manage land. The Native Americans want access to sacred sites, and the land trusts, which maybe are more white suburbanites, want to learn about some of the land management practices that have historically been done to respect the land. So I think there's a lot of ways that, despite our modern context, we can start to engage more meaningfully and directly with nature.
And then nature, the movement to give rights to nature. I know that you, David Bollier, have been very involved in developing a legal framework for the commons. And you contrast a formal law that you say privileges private property and capitalist markets versus vernacular law. What does that mean?
Well, vernacular law means what's going on in the street among people, real people. You know, in the English, when English commons were prevalent in the 1600s, for example, people developed their own ways of managing that farmland in a way that was both fair to people as well as ecologically rejuvenating and sustainable. And I think that that's, we need to develop vernacular, first of all, practices, but then find ways for them to find representation in law. And this is particularly difficult in American law or Western jurisprudence, because it all privileges individuals, individual contract rights, individual property rights. And there are often not provisions for collective stewardship. The ones that do exist are often, you might call them legal hacks, the way community land trusts have used property law as a way to manage land for shared purposes. But, you know, the U.S. government, when they killed so many Native Americans, insisted that the Native Americans give up their communal land management and become individual property holders. So this is kind of the challenge that we face in overcoming some of the deep, deep presumptions of law, categories of thinking, and developing commons-friendly forms of law that can protect them over time.
And this would apply, let's say, to things like protecting water. I mean, you give the example of the acequias. Tell us about them. This is in the Southwest, which is in a mega drought. So managing water on an individual basis is just not going to work going forward, is it?
No, that is actually what I call the tragedy of the market, because the individuals are all sort of taking all they want. But acequias in New Mexico were derived from the Hispanic tradition when they were natives there. And to this day, there are acequias that have state law recognition for a community of people to manage basically the water and the ditches within the ditches for containing the water within that watershed. And they've proven remarkably successful and resilient, despite it being a highly arid region, because they understand the limits. They understand people have to be personally involved in helping to maintain the system, maintain the ditches. And this is in stark contrast to the suburban developments often adjacent to the acequias, which are fast depleting the groundwater supplies and can't get enough ever. So acequias are kind of a model for how we can begin as a commons to set limits on ourselves, to take responsibility individually and collectively. And I think this is kind of a little microcosm, or you might even say a case study, for how we're going to get to a post-capitalist place. We start to grow these alternatives that are functional in a place-based way, and we start to step up to some of the social practices and norms we need to develop.
So one thing that I'm concerned about, I guess, in many of these, of course, this is not an issue. This is, you know, groups of people, often indigenous people or people in so-called disadvantaged communities who come together and find a different way of doing things. But also others of these methods are very much at this point very much just open to people who have money. You know, I think of my local CSA, for example, which is incredibly expensive to join, or the slow food movement, you know, where to go to a slow food meeting, you have to pay $75 or $100 for a meal. This is just not going to be workable and doesn't really do a whole lot to redress the inequalities that are created by the capitalist system. How do we change that?
Well, you're absolutely right that many of the first adopters are the gentrified classes. And I've heard it said that co-ops, when a co-op is being proposed for one region, the real estate agents perk up because it suggests that that neighborhood is gentrifying. I think that this is, you know, a reality of the world, but let's not forget that the commons and commoning have been an age-old survival system, the way mutual aid networks have been about survival during the pandemic. And I think it comes down to cultivating the sensibilities within those gentrified communities to reach out, to be inclusive, to not simply sit on their privilege the way they might be inclined to do, but to engage the other elements of the community. And I think that commoning, as I said, has a lot of survival value in these different contexts, but there is a need for, you might call, venture commoning money or infrastructures or finance to help them work so that not only the well-heeled can be the first to take advantage of them. We see this in the global South, of course, where there's an estimated 2 billion people whose everyday livelihoods depend upon subsistence commons of forests and fisheries and wild game and irrigation water and so forth. That's not a gentrified thing. That's a survival thing, or not even necessarily survival. It's a household non-market thing. I think that's a sensibility we need to cultivate here. And it, by decommodifying our life, by reducing our dependency on, you know, global predatory markets, I think we enhance not only our economic well-being, but our personal well-being.
And now talk about the personal well-being, the development of different values. You know, we live in a world where people seem to be increasingly set against each other, where the notion of solidarity is attacked every day on our, you know, political and economic levels. Talk about the personal, you know, the emotional and the personal enrichment that people get when they do commoning.
Well, you know, I think that it was nicely put by the Guardian columnist George Monbiot, who said that the virtues of a commons is that it gives community life a clear focus. It depends on democracy in its truest form. It destroys inequality. It provides an incentive to protect the living world. And in sum, it creates a politics of belonging. And I think the point is that relationality is the key to a commons, our relationships with each other and the earth, with future and past generations. And this starts to open us up more as inner beings, even spiritually, than, say, the market ideal of all of us as self-interested, rational, utility-maximizing materialists. That's the standard economic definition. So I think the commons, by putting forward a different ideal of human being, a life-respecting one, the way we just talked about the new animism, helps us realize that we're immersed in this living mystery that's a wonder, a miracle. And it starts to open us up to different ways of being and knowing and doing things that, frankly, markets have no interest in.
Well, it is a wonderful book, really inspiring to read, The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, Tools for the Transitions Ahead. David Bollier, it's been a privilege to talk with you about this book, and thank you so much for the work that you do in the world.
Well, thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure to speak with you again and to have this conversation.
David Bollier is the founder of the website onthecommons.org and the host of the podcast Frontiers of Commoning. Go to writersvoice.net for links to more of his work, resources on the commons, and to download a digital version of the Commoner's Catalog. The Supreme Court has stripped away the constitutional right of women to make their own reproductive choices. Overturning Roe v. Wade is just the beginning, I fear, of an all-out assault on women's rights, the rights of LGBTQ people, and other crucial rights, like the right to vote and the right to protect the environment. It's a horrific shock, but not unexpected. It's been coming for years, as the right to reproductive freedom has been steadily chipped away. Back in 2015, we spoke with Katha Pollitt about her book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. It's as relevant today as ever. Katha Pollitt, welcome to Writer's Voice. In Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, first of all, I have to say I was thrilled to read this book. It felt like a clarion call to finally saying the things that so many pro-choice people have been afraid to say for so many years. You say you wrote the book because you wanted to put women back into the center of the abortion debate. We're not at the center?
No, I think they've been nudged off stage by the, quote, fetus, unquote, the unborn. They never say fertilized egg. They never say embryo, although most abortions are actually of embryos. It's always the fetus or the unborn child. And that's mostly what the debate and discussion revolves around.
And yet, I'm old enough to remember before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was just legal in certain states, but not the law of the land. At that time, it seems to me women were at the center of it. In fact, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women.
Yes, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women. And the women's movement at that time was very, very clear about this was a question of women's health, women's lives, women's ability to lead the kind of life that they chose. It was about poverty. It was about all kinds of things, but it was not about the life of the unborn. That issue was for women to think about privately. And if they thought it was wrong to have an abortion, they shouldn't have one.
You actually say that this construction, however, the construction of abortion that Roe versus Wade, the way it framed it as a right to privacy, was not the best way to frame it. And you frame it differently. You frame it as an issue of equality. Could you talk about what's the difference between privacy and equality in terms of the implications for the right to legal abortions?
I think I don't put it as strongly as you do, the point about privacy and equality. The Roe versus Wade makes the privacy argument, and many people have said, oh, it would have been better if Justice Blackmun had based the right to an abortion on women's equality, that being able to control your childbearing is essential for women to be in the workforce and to, you know, be equal to men. I think there's a lot to be said for that point of view, although I think privacy is also important. I don't see why it couldn't have had two reasons, you know. And he was presented with the equality argument. There were amicus briefs that made that argument, and he picked privacy. And I think he picked privacy because if you read Roe v. Wade, it's very focused on doctors and their rights and on health, and that the privacy argument fits in better with that kind of a framework. But I think that without the right to control your body, you really don't have very many rights at all. At any moment, you can get pregnant, and then at that moment, your entire life is turned upside down. Whether you had voluntary sex, involuntary sex, whatever your state of health, however old you are, all the rest, none of that matters. You're pregnant, so that's what matters. That's a very, very large burden for women and only women to bear as they go through life. What I say in my book, though, is some people say the outcome for abortion rights would have been very different had Roe v. Wade based its argument for legal abortion on equality rather than privacy. And that's what I wonder about, because the anti-abortion movement, I think, would have developed just the same, you know? And the same people who have a problem with privacy for women have a problem with equality for women. And so I don't think it would have been any different in the long run. I think the actual words of Roe v. Wade and the actual arguments of Roe v. Wade matter a lot less than what Roe v. Wade did.
But at least it would have kept the woman at the center of the debate. And one of the things that you do in your book, Katha Pollitt, that you do in Pro, is to show how the pro-choice movement itself has become apologetic about the demands for access to abortion. I wonder if you could talk about how this debate has shifted, how the frame has shifted, and how those who are pro-choice have shifted along with it, and what that has done to the movement, to cede ground to the anti-abortionists.
Right. Well, I would say that when abortion was first legalized and the emphasis was on women, you found people saying, you know, a popular slogan was abortion on demand and without apology. That framework of not just I have the right to control my body, but I have the right to lead the life I want to lead, and a stray sperm should not get in the way of that. that framework has been replaced by a much more apologetic one, which is, oh, abortion is just, it should be safe, legal, and rare, which was the Clinton mantra. Abortion is, oh, it's the most difficult decision a woman ever makes. And in your, I'm thinking, really? A woman who had no thought or interest in having a baby gets pregnant, and all of a sudden she's seriously thinking to herself, oh, I really should have this baby, but I don't think that's the way it works. And I think that what that framework is about, this new one, is it's trying to placate the growing sense that there's something deeply wrong about abortion, and it has to be legal because women will die if they have to and be injured, if they have to seek illegal procedures. But it's really a terrible thing, and women should feel really bad about it. I think it's an acceptance of stigma.
In fact, you say we need to treat abortion not as rare, but as common. How common is abortion?
Well, abortion is very common, although the number of abortions has been declining for quite some time. But the statistic you often hear is that 1 in 3 women will have had at least one abortion by menopause. And even if the abortion rate goes down and it turns out to be, okay, 1 in 4, that's still a lot of people.
So it's this common, and I can come out and say right now that I'm one of those 1 in 3. In fact, I'm surprised it's not higher. But I think women tend to be quite secret about the numbers of abortions that they have. I wonder if you could talk about that, you know, the pressure to keep this secret.
It's so true. It is just so true. Now, interestingly, my book got a lot of reviews, and in 3 of them, the author said, I had an abortion. And in one of those cases, that woman hadn't told anybody. And I think it is very hard for women to talk about their abortions. And my hope is that the book will encourage people to do that. If you can do that, if you're in a safe place where you can do that, you'd really be helping a lot of women. Because since women tend not to talk about this, even sometimes with their closest friends, even with their husbands, then the perception is never challenged that abortion is not just not all that common, but that the people who have abortions, this is important, the people who have abortions are the stereotypical, teenager running wild, the slutty co-ed, 20-somethings who are just selfish and want to have fun, and the most popular one of all, the cold-hearted career woman who hates children. And so there's a perception that, the people who have abortions aren't people like me, an upstanding Christian or a decent person or the mother of several children. And I'll just say by way of parenthesis that now, these days, most women who have abortions are already mothers, which tells you something right there about how these stereotypes don't fit reality.
The stigma that is attendant on it, you turn that around and say not only is it not immoral to have an abortion, but often it is the moral decision. Could you
I think that's really true. I support women, women making their own decision, whatever they do, but I think that there's just no question that it's good to have children when you're in a good place to take care of them. It's not a good idea to have 10 children that you can't pay proper attention to. And it's not a good idea to have children when you're too young or when you need your education or when you already have several children. A lot of women have children that are disabled and their hands are totally full taking care of those children. I think a lot of women have abortions because they're thinking about the children they already have and what those children need and how much the woman has to give to them.
Right. That was certainly true in my case. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the anti-abortion movement. Their policy has been to restrict more and more, to chip away at the rights granted by Roe versus Wade. Talk about the changes in the landscape of access to abortion that has been going on for the last 30 years, and where are we right now?
Well, I'm sure your listeners know that in the last couple of years, there have been a tremendous number of laws passed in the states restricting access to abortion, over 200 in the last 2 years. And this is all related to Republican success in the states and in controlling state legislatures and governorships. And that's why we've seen, for example, you know, so many clinics closed in Texas, and why there is only one abortion clinic left in Missouri, which is a big state, and where they've just passed a 72-hour waiting period. Clinics have closed in Ohio, in Virginia, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania. You know, I think for a long time people thought, oh, okay, it's North Dakota and South Dakota that, you know, they each only have one clinic left, that the success of the pro-life movement has been limited to low-population rural states that are far away from most of the rest of America. But to the extent that it ever was true, it's not true anymore. Now we're seeing that it isn't just in red states where clinics are closing. It's in some pretty purple states, too. So the combination of clinics closing as a result of what are called trap laws, targeted regulation of abortion providers, these are the laws that will typically require a clinic to renovate or remodel in ways that have no bearing on their ability to provide services, but that are very expensive. And that's a way of shutting them down. If you make a clinic do $1 million worth of architectural changes, and also this requirement that doctors have admitting privileges within, you know, 30 miles of the clinic, but then no hospital will give them those admitting privileges. So that's another way of shutting them down. So between the trap laws and the ever-increasing restrictions, it's much harder to get an abortion in much of the country than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Katha Pollitt about her new book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Now, just a little point. I noticed that although in the book you do clarify the issue of what to call the anti-abortion movement, you just referred to them as pro-life.
Right. I use the word pro-life when I'm talking about the political movement that calls itself pro-life. But I try to avoid using that word to describe the ideas of that movement or the individuals. And I try to call them abortion opponents, anti-abortion, words like that, because I don't think they are pro-life. I think that's a propaganda word.
There's one example in the book where they cut support to children who are already born in order to fund these clinics, so-called clinics that
right.
are pushing women.
To fund the crisis pregnancy centers, right. That happens. There's been a big transfer of wealth away from born children to fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses. And who thinks that's a good idea?
And so talking about fetuses and embryos, you have a marvelous chapter in the book about what is a person. Talk about that within the context of, you know, what is a person and then is a woman a person? I think to link those two ideas together.
Well, anti-choicers, of course, base a lot on the personhood, the supposed personhood of the fertilized egg, embryo, and fetus. And I look at, well, what do we mean when we say something is someone is a person? We don't mean that they're some DNA. You know, we mean things like they have consciousness, they have arms and legs and a head, they have social relationships, they have all the qualities, or at least some of the qualities that a born person has that a fertilized egg, for example, does not have. And you can see how this language of personhood, it's very iffy, because the fertilized egg in a woman, it's a person. Even before it's implanted, from the moment of conception, it's a person. But that same fertilized egg in a petri dish, in a fertility clinic, that's not a person. And although there are some anti-abortion people who would say, no, it's a person when it's in the petri dish too, that's never going to get anywhere, because we love fertility medicine in America. That's all about making babies. So if you have to destroy a whole bunch of fertilized eggs and pre-embryos to achieve that worthy goal, that's fine. Fertility doctors don't have to go to work in bulletproof vests. But that just shows you that it's really about women. It's really about women, and it's about sex. That's how that fertilized egg got in that woman is very important.
Say more about that. Yeah. What do you mean it's about sex? I mean, it's not just about sex, oh, we love sex. It's about sex in a very different way.
Right. Well, you can see this, too. Most Americans, the very, very large majority of Americans, would say that to have an abortion if you're raped is okay. But to have an abortion when you had voluntary sex, unless there's a serious health problem, is not okay. Well, why is that? From the point of view of the embryo, if an embryo can be said to have a point of view, it's just the same. And yet, for most people, it feels quite different. It's as if they think sex is a kind of contract to have a baby if a baby is started. What a lot of people are very disturbed by the separation of sex and reproduction. That just seems like that's where it all went wrong, when people just, you know, all this hedonism, all this wild 60s stuff, people just doing what they want. It's all bad.
But only having to do with women. I mean, I haven't seen anything about trying to control the sexuality of men.
Well, that's true. And you do wonder, well, how would that be done, right? I mean, how would that happen? They would say, well, he has to pay child support. But child support is nothing like having to risk your health and life and your social position and all your hopes and dreams in pregnancy and childbirth. There's just no comparison there. And it's also the woman, too, has to pay child support to herself, right? I mean, there aren't that many men who are bearing the full 50% cost of raising a child to adulthood. And there are many, many who pay nothing. So it's about controlling women's sexuality. And I do think that that is what a lot of the anti-abortion movement is all about.
Do you actually say the aim is really not just to make abortion illegal? In fact, that the agenda goes far beyond that, and it's really not even about that.
Well, yeah, birth control. I mean, this is a really fascinating thing. When pro-choicers started saying, you know, they're coming for your birth control too, this was widely poo-pooed in the mainstream media, sort of like, oh, these pro-choicers, they're always such hysterics. You know, it's always Chicken Little with the sky falling. But, you know, time passes, and now you can see it's really true. When all this defunding of Planned Parenthood means less access to birth control, flat funding for Title X, which is the federal program that provides birth control to poor women. And then a very interesting feature is the way more and more the pro-life movement is trying to make a case that birth control is actually a form of abortion. So, for example, emergency contraception causes an abortion, which is not true. It prevents ovulation. It will not interfere with an established pregnancy, and it doesn't even apparently prevent implantation. It prevents ovulation. But they don't accept that science. They have their own facts. The birth control pill, more abortion. The IUD, abortion. And I'm thinking, why aren't they happy that the vast majority of studies and science and medicine say these things are not abortions? Why aren't they saying, well, this is great. Here's the wonderful compromise. We're against abortion, but we love birth control. But they don't say that. They say we're against abortion, and birth control is another form of abortion. So that's where you can see that there's a real anti-women sexuality component in all this.
You know, this puts me in mind of The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's prescient novel. And yet, even with all that we've been talking about, the legal right to abortion still remains in the polls, overwhelmingly supported by the American people. Do we risk getting to The Handmaid's Tale or something like that? Your book is aimed at the muddled middle, you say. I mean, obviously people like myself and like you are very clear about the necessity of keeping abortion legal. What has to happen to really build a movement that can support the rights that a vast majority of American women and men support?
Well, I don't think we're going to end up with The Handmaid's Tale version of life. I think women have come much too far to be turned back and confined in that way. I think we might see abortion not available in a lot of red states and in a lot of areas in blue states. But there are states where abortion rights are very popular. For example, New York and California. But we might see that abortion, you can't get an abortion in the middle of the country. You know, you can get an abortion on the coasts and maybe a few big cities in between, like Chicago. But basically, it will be very hard to get. And I could also see abortion being made much harder to get than it already is after the first trimester, because these polls depend a lot on how you ask the question. If you ask the question, do you agree with the Roe v. Wade decision, which made abortion legal through most of pregnancy, people will say, yes, I agree with that. But if you ask them, you know, well, what about abortion in the second trimester? That support falls way off. What about abortion in the third trimester? Almost nobody's in favor of that. And one of the things I talk about in my book is people don't really know what all these things mean. Like, they don't know that it's, you know, there are like three places in the whole country where you can get a third trimester abortion, and which are usually for pretty serious reasons. Now, you ask about how can we have a strong pro-choice movement. And I would say, you know, my hope is that it's already starting. I think with the youngest cohort of activists, we are seeing a vigor and energy and in-your-faceness that is something quite fresh. And that's really great. For example, you see women tweeting their abortions, filming their abortions, refusing to accept that whole stigmatized framework. You see new organizations that are fighting stigma, which I think is an essential step. You know, you're not going to get people mobilized around this issue as long as they feel ashamed of what they've done. So there's a new organization called Sea Change that organizes book clubs to discuss an anthology that they've put together of stories about all aspects of reproduction written by all sorts of women. And then the women in the book club talk about it. And what often comes out is how many of them have had abortions and how they feel about it. And that's huge.
Well, Kathy Pollitt, I want to thank you so much for writing this book. It's actually a terrific read. I just found myself on the subway going, yes!
Oh, that makes me so happy.
It's called Pro, and I urge all my listeners, male and female alike, to go out and get it. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Kathy Pollitt talking to us in 2015.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.